Hello, everyone. This is Greg, your host of Goddamn GameCube, and this is Season 4. Follow Goddamn GameCube on social for updates on the show, and subscribe to us on YouTube for bonus video content. Thank you, and enjoy today's episode. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Goddamn GameCube. My name is Greg. I'm going to be your host today. I'm very excited for this one. We are doing Disco Elysium today, and we do have a full house. Riley, of course, my co-host is here. Nick, the intern, is here. Our friend Kyle is here as well. A small disclaimer before we start the show. Disco Elysium does use slurs and inappropriate language in a sort of made-up language, so we are not going to use those slurs on the show. If you hear any censor noises, we are not actually saying those slurs live. So, with that being said, I am gonna kick this to Riley. We're already laughing. Go
speak
ahead.
For yourself.
This is one of the funniest disclaimers I've ever heard.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Don't worry, guys. We're not actually saying it.
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to intro super quick before I kick it to our friend Kyle. This game originally came out in 2019. I did not play the original release. It was there was a re-release in 2021 called The Final Cut. Developed and published by Zaum Studios, their first and only release so far. The Final Cut featured a lot more voice acting, including all your internal thoughts and stuff, replaced certain performances they felt were lacking, and included a couple extra side quests. And so, Kyle, you were actually the first of us to play this. Did you originally play the first version or the Final Cut, or what was your history with this?
Yeah, so I had not heard of it at the time of release, because I was kind of preoccupied with The Outer Worlds. It's a CRPG, an isometric CRPG in the style of like Fallout 1, Fallout 2, Baldur's Gate.
I wanted to bring up before we get too far, there's a lot of kind of stuff about Robert Kurvitz, the sort of lead designer. He has done a number of interviews. They're all fascinating. Definitely recommend you watch some of them. But he describes himself as a pen and paper evangelist, and I think that comes across very clear in the making of this game. His intent was to start a sort of cultural movement, where this team is sort of like a misfit kind of crew of people who have like attempted other things. You know, at one point they attempted a novel, which is kind of set in the Disco Elysium world. And they eventually is like, yeah, let's try making a video game. And I thought that was kind of cool. And something he said was, we are not elitists. We just wanted to make something that was comprehensible, but on our own terms. And I think that's a pretty noble goal.
I mean, I do consider this to be one of the games where they really gave a shit about this game. So 100%. I think that comes through.
Oh, definitely.
So the setting of this game, it is a fictionalized universe, sort of a semi-steampunk aesthetic, informed by the main dude I was just talking about, growing up in Eastern Europe and the remnants of the Soviet Union. An unconventional setting, I would say. Very, very detailed. Basically, I think the intent was the team was very invested in those details. And he was like, if I make it like its own little world, everyone will be really passionate about, you know, using their imagination to kind of flesh it out and stuff. So this is, I'm trying to delineate it for the audience. If you're unfamiliar, this is a totally new world. Like, it has no resemblance to our own, I guess. It is the district you're in is called Martinez. The city is Ravishal, and I guess the continent is, it's in Isola. And you see some familiar things that are, you know, kind of obviously taken from our world. It makes you sort of think that the world works the same way as ours, which sucks you in. But it's one of the strangest experiences I've had, where the more you can ask a lot of like stupid questions, but like the more questions you ask, you're like, oh, wait, fundamental things are different, and I'm not an idiot for asking these questions. And I think that's awesome. And you, the more you ask, the more you realize it's completely different. So you're the character you play as is this amnesiac mess of a detective, and his sort of straight-laced partner from an adjacent precinct. They have to collaborate on a murder investigation. The background of this is a dock workers strike, company versus union. It's kind of the center of the conflict. The mystery of your identity also plays a huge part, as well as what happened the previous night. So that is kind of your basic setup here. As Kyle mentioned, it's an isometric camera angle, but it's very unusual where the backdrop is sort of an oil painting or watercolor
yes.
kind of expressionist look. There are sort of skill portraits, like, you know, where you level up your attributes that are a lot of disembodied kind of eyes and mouth that kind of just represent like stuff that's buried in your like lizard brain. I would say that the areas in this game are very kind of iconic looking, like the main like statue with the horse on it and everything. Very uniquely designed stuff, and it all feels believable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, you know, harkening back to our Resident Evil 2 episode where, you know, you're striking that line between believable and memorable, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and I thought about something else that was funny is that you have these kind of small, minimalist little 3D character models that are crawling across this painting, I guess. The soundtrack, I think, is very memorable.
Oh yeah,
This band called Sea Power did it. You gotta.
I do. This is Disco Elysium was such a strange like sound experience for me.
Yeah,
because you know, Sea Power is formerly British Sea Power,
right?
And like, this is really strange. Like, you know, back in like 2004, 2005, I was all about all of those English bands from like the New Music Express. You know, I was very into that scene of bands, like whether it's like, you know, the Libertines and the Killers
right.
and Razor Light and all that stuff. And when I heard that like British Sea Power did the soundtrack to this game, I'm like, wait, them? Like
yeah.
the band?
Yeah, I remember you were like, wait, from
what?
A long time
I was ago. Like, you mean that undercurrent British band from like the
right.
mid-2000s? Why? That's so bizarre.
And it's perfect because it is very much like an underdog pick.
Yeah,
like
of course.
Someone who was kind of like passed over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all great, and like their most recent, totally caught up with them. Their most recent album is awesome and has a little bit of overlap with the soundtrack of this mm-hmm. game. They have a lot of when you're kind of exploring the city, you have a lot of this sort of somber but somewhat proud like trumpet motifs that are going on, and it kind of evokes like a fallen, you know, country or civilization. You know, it's history. You have some kind of tense and scary moments, like when you're hanging out at the docks, you have that very industrial sounding. It kind of sounds like an engine going back and down, down, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. I love the music that plays in the church. It's very, very serene. The rave, of course, is
sure.
iconic.
That might be my favorite song.
It's really, yeah. really intense. So when it comes to, we talked a lot about, you know, the reading and everything and how everything sort of pops up in this little text box. And I found it so unique that they did that and they preferred that over sort of your standard subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was kind of funny that the reason that they did this was because they talked about how the bottom right corner of your computer screen is like where all your stuff is, like your clock and all your mm-hmm. other stuff. And it was pretty much unfolding like a social media feed, mm-hmm. like where you're getting like you're okay. kind of getting your timeline and it's scrolling up and up. And the dialogue was I think it went through a lot of iterations, but it was intended to be very incisive and kind of punchy to keep mm-hmm. your attention. You constantly have characters like insulting you or like mm-hmm. screaming at you and stuff. And they include a lot of humor as a way, like the guy was saying, like you are invariably going to get people who are bored, so you reward them with jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great way to handle it.
I really appreciated that.
Yeah, the humor is pretty excellent. The skill voices are, you know, your internal thoughts. They are sort of more of a reinforcement of your main I guess like whatever you're thinking at the time, the only volition really gives you a new idea, which I thought was interesting.
I was going to comment on this internal monologue. It actually took me a little bit of time to understand what was going on.
Oh yeah.
Where like, you know, there's so much dialogue happening. There's a ton of voice acting, a ton of reading. And I'm like, what does this mean? Like, where, you know, all the skill names are also very odd, like Inland Empire, Volition, Savior Fair. There's a lot of, all the skills are bizarre. And when I was listening to this voice acting, I said, is this my internal monologue? Like, what is this? It's your skills actually talking to you and giving you advice or speaking out loud. It's really odd.
It's very reminiscent of, I don't know if any of our audience has seen a Peep Show, but it's a comedy series that is from the perspective of a couple guys, and you hear all their stupid, like, internal thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very similar to that, where it's just kind of even bad ideas kind of get there. You hear everything.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say? I just also wanted to add on to that, and I didn't learn this until my second playthrough. Sometimes your thoughts fight with each other.
Yes.
It's really funny because sometimes like they'll even chime in when you fail something.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like mock you.
Yeah. They'll make fun of you.
And they're not necessarily because it's all you. You're the unreliable kind of internal narrator. So it's not necessarily going to give you the right idea. And I think I've never seen anything like that before.
Gives you an idea. Doesn't mean it's going to be right.
Right.
Yeah. Something
and
to think
not
about.
Only that, but a lot of the intent behind having these multiple different, you know, kind of facets of your personality and brain is because they were talking about how you don't fully understand something unless it's been to explain to you 2, 3, 8 different times, different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you don't fully understand something, you have no interest in it, or you don't appreciate the stakes. And I thought that was a really good point. If you kind of reinforce it in all these different ways, they're all going to have their different perspectives on it, which you can review by scrolling up. It's a very interesting way of making sure you're engaged, making sure you're keeping up with what's going on. So in terms of overall presentation, what would you say some of the pros and cons of this were?
Sure. I think I'll start, then I'll kick it to Kyle, then we'll go to Nick.
No, go to Nick first.
Oh, sure. I think we kind of brought it up already, but it when you get that sort of isometric style, it kind of, the way I describe Disco Elysium to people is, people who have never heard of it, it's also kind of a tough game to sell unless you're into this kind of stuff.
I wouldn't even know where to start.
Exactly. What I tend to tell people is if you like point and click like Nancy Drew games on the computer, but you want an adult version, it would be this.
Detective stuff.
Exactly.
I
think presentation wise, when you get this top down, watercolor is a good word for it. You get this top down watercolor, but there is a ton of reading. It can be a little bit overwhelming with how much you have to ingest and read. This game probably took me 2 or 3 hours to get into the swing of
click.
Yeah. Right.
Because I felt like I was very divided between like the main window and the, you know, scrolling over to my
feed. Of course.
You
know? And it took me a while to understand sometimes dialogue is internal, sometimes it's external. They're going to fight amongst themselves. There's a lot to ingest.
Yeah.
I mean, Nick, what was your take?
So, I mean, the presentation of this game is obviously very high quality. I loved all the little art of all the skills and all the character designs, the character portraits. I thought that was awesome. As far as like all the reading and all that on the sidebar goes, I think I picked up pretty quick that was going on. It took me some time to like you all to kind of get into it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys are all the same way, but I'm this is going to sound weird coming from me. When I play a video game, I typically don't play the ones that act out sort of like visual novels. I'm not saying this game is a visual novel, but, you know, there's a ton of reading almost to the point of a visual novel.
You're not like a big like Telltale person.
Right.
Whatever.
Like I like my books to be books, like my games to be games, like my movies to be movies. So this is something a totally different experience for me. And honestly, I ended up loving it. I love that presentation. I will say if we're talking about presentation, one thing I did not like, just because it's in that isometric style, sometimes I found it a little bit difficult to maneuver, like getting up a staircase.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like, I remember I got stuck in Everard's office for like 2 hours. You know, I could not get out.
The toughest spot for me was in front of the strike, going up the stairs to talk to that guy whose legs are dangling. Got turned around so many times.
Yeah. So I thought that was a little tough. But other than that, presentation was pretty spot on for me.
Kyle, do you have any other thoughts on presentation before we move on?
What do I have here? I mean, like, the oil color aesthetic is really interesting.
Very unique.
Talking about the thoughts.
Yeah.
I really like...
They look awesome.
I really like, when you first start the game and you're going down into the Whirling of Rags to meet Kim, you can pass by that, guy that's passed out on the counter. And if you have, a high enough physique, your electrochemistry will be like, look at that stain. Look it right now.
Yeah.
And it's just like, what? No. Dude. What do you want me to do? It's like, you know you want it.
You can ask the guy, you know where I can get some alcohol?
Right.
Yeah, you can wake him up and hey, buddy, where do I get some booze? Yeah.
I just think in summary of presentation, there is a lot of detail in this game and you kind of have to stomach where... I'm not going to call it overwhelming, but it teeters on that line. There's a lot to ingest.
Yeah. Saying, the original release of this game, it was essentially a novel.
Yeah.
It was a very well-written novel, but as Nick was saying, I also like my games to be games.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, and it adding in the voices really helped with that.
It helps, number one, that voice actor who does all your internal thoughts is excellent.
Yes.
But also, from what I understand, all the... re-recordings were improved it immensely. So we're gonna get a little bit into the mechanics here. I think this game is fascinating because it is very sort of cerebral when it comes to not only its themes but the way it executes them. So in the beginning, that we talked about all the pen and paper kind of influence on this game, and it has never been clear that kind of the dice roll is an act of God. Kind of stuff you can't plan for.
Sure.
And your skills and percentages are sort of just ways of making your own luck, making your own, improving your own odds.
Yeah.
Because there's things that you can't count for. As he put it, Robert Kurvitz put it, we make wishes to our mind and body and hope that they cooperate, which I thought was a very good way of putting it.
Great quote.
I don't have any... backup for this, but I thought that the quick save was clearly made to be exploited.
Well, yes and no. I think it's in there because players are going to play it that way, like me.
Sure.
But I think, Kyle, you and I have talked about this a little bit, where Disco Elysium is very interesting, where failure is actually a way of progressing, where it's not really a failure state. The game is built that way.
A fun fact, by the way, if you start the game with just one endurance, which is the one that determines how much health you have, if you start with just one health, you can actually die in the first 2 minutes of the game because you can reach for the tie on the ceiling fan and fail and you die.
Attack.
You have a heart attack.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
The fact that the game allows you to do that, I find really funny.
That's they don't really treat you with kid gloves as much as a Fallout or something.
No, they don't.
I just want to maybe summarize because there may be members of our audience who have not played this. For me, the best way to summarize Disco Elysium is there is no combat. It is all Dungeons and Dragons dice rolls and dialogue.
Right.
That's the entirety of the
gameplay. Well, there is a combat scenario, but it's not a traditional, you don't have
one. No, it's totally dice roll.
Sure.
But yeah, like you said, you have a health and psyche meter, which is your, mental well-being.
Yep.
And you have medicine and drugs that can mess with that. And then later we'll get into, the different things that can affect it. In their words, skills sort of examine the fear and anxiety associated with consciousness. They considered it a thinking simulator.
Jesus Christ.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean, though, right? I want to make it as obvious as possible for the audience that all these little kind of, anxieties and insecurities, I guess you'll say, are kind of cropping up. Skills intentionally giving you bad ideas, for one thing.
Right.
Some of the notable skills I wanted to bring up, Encyclopedia, which is just kind of your useless trivia sort of stuff. Conceptualization, which is sort of your artistic sort of sensibilities. Your pain threshold, you can kind of take a beating or whatever. Physical instrument, getting into fights and stuff like that. Electrochemistry is your sort of ability to handle drugs and alcohol and the various effects that they have. You know, hand-eye coordination, basic stuff like that, interfacing, empathy, where you can kind of more connect to other human beings. Volition, as I mentioned, is the only one that gives you new ideas, which I thought was fascinating because they don't tell you that. It's just kind of like...
Wait, is that real? I didn't know that.
Volition, yeah. So that's it kind of plays into a quest later on where that's the only one that will, you know, like... Because it's just one of many skills.
Yeah.
And the one that Nick and I invested heavily into, Inland Empire.
Fun skill.
The David Lynch film?
Yes. Have you guys seen that movie?
No.
I haven't either.
It's not my favorite movie of his, let's just say that. But it's very much just kind of this 3-hour movie of this woman like having a mental breakdown and like it's almost completely like indiscernible, and that is kind of where that skill comes from, is sort of this random, like almost alien kind of what if this happened, you know, like kind of like getting in touch with insanity. I guess
I just wanted to add to the skills, one of my favorite ones is Half Light, which is essentially just Doomer mode. If you invest heavily into Half-Life
Half-Life 2,
you become Gordon Freeman. If you invest heavily into Half-Light, you essentially end up becoming the apocalypse cop. You're just like, everything sucks, the world's gonna die.
It's kind of funny because those skills can either help you out in certain situations, or they can like put people off.
Yeah.
Like if you say something really off color to a normal person, they're like, what the fuck is wrong with you? So you can do that. You can even mess around with your character's clothing. There's a lot of kind of funny things, but they affect like your skills and how they... You had something to add, Nick?
Oh, yeah. So I wanted to bring up something super interesting about the encyclopedia skill.
Yeah.
All right. So it basically gives you these random tidbits about the world. So one of my favorite things about it is like, if you invest too much into it, you get overwhelmed with all this bullshit that you'll never have to know. Like Harry sometimes says like, okay, that's cool. Why am I thinking about this? You've gone through 5 paragraphs of this encyclopedic stuff. And you're like, wait, who was I talking to again?
Dude,
what am
I
doing?
Living it right now.
And the other thing too about encyclopedia, you know what they do they do it in FromSoft. They do it in other games where like, the world building is told either through like you read a book or you read an item description. Encyclopedia does that right off the bat. Like it's like a way of implementing the world building right in the middle of the conversation without having to do anything extracurricular to get it. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Before we move on, Nick, you touched on something that I was going to touch on.
Ooh, okay.
So I'm not sure how serious it's taken in the game. From what I remember, there is a detriment to having some of your skills be too high.
Yes.
Which I think is fascinating. I fucking love shit like this where they really thought of everything, where if you are, I remember this description. I hope I'm correct. You can correct me if I'm not. I believe under the definition in the game of either logic or one of those skills, if you're too logical, you are not emotional enough and people will find you too strict or too harsh.
Right.
I find that stuff fascinating, where if you're too good at something, it also has a negative effect.
Yeah. Which I love. Like I was saying, that Inland Empire thing, like people are going to look at you like you're insane because you are.
Yeah.
You know, like, I invested pretty heavily into conceptualization. And so whenever my character went on his like diatribes, all this bullshit about like, oh, but the art in this, look at what we could do to the wall. Kim and the characters are like, dude, shut up. What are you doing?
So I mentioned the clothing. So I just wanted to mention some of my favorites, because there's a lot of effort.
I love the clothes.
Sure. So you have a frog visor, which is very cute. and it will also tell you exactly why these particular objects of clothing give you certain skills and stuff. And one of my favorites is like, there's like a racist, like, you know, kind of rice patty hat or whatever.
Yes.
And you get a +1 to logic, and it says super logical for a cop to wear.
Yes. Yes. I remember that.
Unbelievable.
That's amazing.
So you get that. You got the shades of self-destruction, the ones that just look like shit on you and everybody tells you. You have your necktie, which you can talk to if you have Inland Empire. Everything, you know, kind of plays a role into this character building stuff. And what I wanted to talk about a little bit is the part that they had the most difficult time implementing was the thought cabinet.
Mm. Oh, and, yeah.
So they basically introduced this as like sort of as loot, like the loot of conversation is ideas is how they phrased it. They considered it sort of a lofty concept that was hard to perfect and implement. Thought cabinet ideas is a whole separate menu. They can give you skill points, raise skill caps, and reopen, speech checks, that kind of thing. I felt that this one in particular was kind of underutilized. I felt like there was not enough incentive to use it versus just like spending points. I felt like it was, I don't know. Like, I couldn't really tell.
You're talking about the thoughts that get developed and they end up
like
affecting.
You have to spend some time thinking about something.
I actually had a problem with this system too. I had very few problems with this game. The issue I had with this is, now you can correct me, I believe when you started a thought, it had a certain bonus or negative. And when you complete the thought, it changes, but you don't know what the result is going to be.
Right.
So you can waste a lot of points and you really didn't want to have this thought at all.
Exactly.
And it made me save scum this a little bit to get what I wanted.
I'll add, so you can find all of the, like, you're right. When you start the thought, there's a certain amount of time associated with it. Usually there's a debuff to it, like -2 to whatever attribute, and then after a set amount of time has elapsed and you internalize the thought, meaning you save it to one of the 12 spots in your cabinet, you'll either get a, like most of the time it's a positive permanent buff to one of your stats, or some of them will give you like extra XP in conversations. Sometimes there are negative ones as well.
Can I speak on the thought cabinet for just a quick second?
Yeah, absolutely.
I didn't like the thought cabinet at all.
See, I'm fucking telling you.
I thought, honestly, I thought the menu was confusing.
Me
I thought
too.
It was clunky to get through.
Yeah.
I don't mind the whole risk versus reward thing and not knowing what it's going to happen. I didn't mind that terribly.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I thought the menu, maybe because this game is better played on PC than, you know, PS5 is what I played it on. I don't know. I thought navigating that menu and knowing what to do was a little counterintuitive. But
sure.
I don't know. Wasn't a huge fan of the thought catalog. They were funny. And I guess I should have mentioned this when we were talking about presentation. This is probably me and getting old. I thought the text was too small in this game. So when I was in the thought catalog, I'm just like squinting, like I can barely fucking read this.
Yeah.
So not a huge fan of that system.
I've actually started to feel that way with certain games.
Yeah,
too.
See, so it's a thing.
We're getting old.
Yep.
Yeah. Sucks.
Before we move on, I wanted to just quickly rhyme off favorites from this list. You have finger pistols, which is if you have nothing in your hands, you can like do that to people.
That's unbelievable.
I didn't know that.
I think that's awesome. Hobo Cop, which we love, is you get more trash, which you can recycle for money.
That's right.
Jamais Vu, which is you get more XP for learning about the world, which I thought was cool.
Oh, cool.
The opioid receptor antagonist. Which is
what a title.
There are no positives to drugs, but no negatives to alcohol.
That's interesting.
Which is pretty fascinating. The Jamrock Shuffle, which gets you better loot, and White Morning, which allows you to zoom out further into the city. I guess it's connected to that kind of Shivers thing,
neat.
Where you have a better sense of your surroundings.
I didn't know that.
It's neat.
So I think that's pretty cool. Time and money are both important factors in this game that you can kind of waste. And I'm just curious, can you run out? Because I couldn't find a definitive answer to this.
Out of time or money?
Either.
You can definitely run out of money.
I looked it up.
What happens when
you have a total of 10 in-game days?
Oh, okay. So it is timed. Okay.
Yes. Okay. I don't think you're... I struggled to get past day 5 or 6.
Yeah, I don't believe you can actually run out of time. I don't think there's a failure state in that way at all.
Okay.
But in terms of money, maybe Kyle, you can...
Oh, I can answer this too.
Maybe we'll go to Nick. So one of the daily objectives is you have to pay for your hotel room.
Right.
And it's actually hard to do, actually scraping together enough money to do it.
Well, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. Right. I mean, Nick, what were you going to comment on this?
I was commenting, yes, you can run out of money and it's actually a game over.
Yeah. Really?
If you can't afford to stay at the Whirling and Rags and you haven't unlocked the other place to stay,
That's awesome.
Have to sleep outside in the trash and you freeze to death. And you get a game over state.
I love that.
I didn't get that. It's really funny.
Some of the ways that you get money in this game are just really, really... Did any of you find the mega rich light bending guy?
Oh, yeah. I got him saved for later. We're going to go through all the memorable NPCs. But I just wanted to bring those up as a concept, and I didn't know you could actually freeze to death.
It's really funny.
This game thought of everything.
There are so many ways that you can die in this game, and all of them are just really like humorous.
Yeah, they give you a little like sort of a obituary at the end.
Yeah.
But you also have kind of, and I believe they flesh this out a lot more in the final cut with the political spectrum, where your character can kind of. This is sort of part of the thought cabinet, I guess, where your character can sort of be aligned with one of like the four major ideologies. And they're really funny because like everything that you can get into is just sort of poking fun at it, like the weaknesses of everything. And what I thought was amazing was that there is like a fascist like subplot. And the point of it is them being so obsessed with the past that they start thinking about like time travel. And I've never like, how do we get back to those times? Oh, just like, that's so funny. Well, what I loved about this, their approach here, they talked about how the political spectrum is there for the player to encounter, offer an opinion on, get shaped by, but not to solve. And I thought that was a very mature way of looking at it. And I thought there was a very sort of pertinent quote from Kim that really sort of encapsulates how you are sort of left feeling at the end of this game. He says, "Every school of thought and government has failed in this city, but I love it nonetheless. It belongs to me as much as it belongs to you."
What a guy.
Great quote all around.
Let's give it up for Kim, everybody.
All right.
Mr. Kitsuragi.
Yeah, right?
So I guess just capping off this segment, how well do you guys feel that the mechanics work together, and how well do you feel that they serve the overall experience?
Sure. So this game is incredibly unique. Like I said earlier in the episode, it's a little bit of a tough sell if you're not familiar with what we're talking about. But I think you were talking about mechanics as a whole and kind of how this fed into the gameplay.
Right.
I think this game, I have just never played a game like it where it is all Dungeons and Dragons dice rolls and talking to people and pointing and clicking and looking at stuff.
Yeah.
I think depending on what kind of gamer you are, this game is very much like a Save Scummer's Paradise kind of game.
Oh, yeah.
Where if I'm not going to get the dice roll I want, I am going to reload it. And I just couldn't help but do that.
Well, especially if I want to find out what would happen if, you know, what would happen if I got that right? You know, I'm curious.
Right.
In the moment.
I think I'm not sure if like an FU autosave from like a FromSoft game would have helped or hurt this game. Yeah. I'm not really sure. But for me, the game is very unique for better or worse. I don't know if maybe Kyle wants to take it next and we'll go to Nick.
What I wanted to say was with the save scumming, I did save some save scum as well. But what this game does, which I think is really clever, when you get to day 3 and you're allowed to go to the other side of the island where the church is, you'll find that door at the top, the impossible to open door. And I think... even if you have your physical instrument at the highest it can be, you'll fail. And I find that really funny because Kim will interject and he's like, perhaps this is a sign that you can't do
like
everything.
Some doors
and you actually get
opened.
A thought because of that. And I thought that was a really clever way of introducing that.
Like, right.
We know you can save scum if you want to. Just know that some things aren't always going to work out in your
solvable.
Favor. And I thought that was really like smart.
So a phrase that we've used on this show pretty frequently
Fair
in
amount.
Season 3 was ludonarrative dissonance.
Yeah.
This game does the opposite.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if there's a term for it. I don't know if there's a legit term for the opposite.
Ludonarrative correctness?
Correctness, companionship, harmony.
Symbiosis.
I don't know. Yeah. Something like that.
But where's the other Nick?
Yeah, right. I don't know if there's an official term for it, but anyway, it's a gamer term, whatever. But that's what this game does that I haven't really seen a lot of games try and do. But I think it works extremely well. As far as save scumming goes, I only save scummed when I failed a very high percent dice roll. Otherwise, I just let it go.
If
it was like 75% or higher and I failed, I went, all right, man, and I reloaded it.
Right.
But although there is one that I did purposely because I wanted to see what would happen, I did save scum a 20% to beat the shit out of Measurehead.
Yeah,
I saved scum that one.
You gotta. Well, I think what's cool about that too is that it's you can save scum, but not only that is still sort of if you have a lower percentage, your time, your in real life time is being eaten up by trying it over and over again. So there's still kind of a push and pull of that kind of thing. But you guys have anything else to add before we get into the story?
Let's get into the story. The most important part.
Yep. Full spoilers here for the story.
Yep.
So you start out, your character is only known in the beginning as HDB. Mm-hmm. And is this balding, like kind of just mutton overweight detective, guy. Clearly an alcoholic. And you start out in this hostel called the Whirling in Rags. And it's, you know, it's kind of dumpy, but it's like, it's charming in its own way. Mm-hmm. And this detective from an adjacent precinct we mentioned, Kim Kitsuragi, he's going to be your partner on this investigation because there's an overlap in their jurisdiction, I guess. So you got to figure out who strung up this guy behind the Whirling in Rags. And what I think is so funny is like, maybe one of the like pretty much the first guy you meet is Gart, the sort of caretaker, and he is immediately like, yeah, you owe me like a shitload of money. And it's just like, oh my god, what am I walking into here? And it becomes sort of its own little side quest for the first day, where you are, you know, trying to collect trash and everything, and you have to get really. I think Greg, you did it. You scraped together enough money on the first day without resorting to. Kim is like, oh, I got these rims off somebody.
And I felt so bad.
Yeah, you have to pawn them.
Man, I felt terrible. He loved those things.
But yeah, like the first day, I think for most people is very much like just fumbling around trying to figure out what's going on. And you wind up like thinking about what you've accomplished on the first day. And it's like, okay, I got some stuff done. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand, you know, I've met a lot of people, you know, I did. So you can get a good amount done. And I think it's so funny that they settled on like these guys for like the main characters, because they're talking about how they deliberately avoided like a chosen one subplot or anything. They're like the underdog is you got to root for him, you know, like he's way more interesting. You wind up going to try and investigate the body. But a little boy is throwing rocks at it. And we all know this is the beloved Kuno.
Okay, so this is where I think I rarely laugh out loud, like when I play games.
Yeah.
And I said earlier in the episode, you know, this game, they say a lot of rude words and a lot of bad stuff. So you walk up to this really rude boy named Kuno, and then you walk up to him, and then he goes, "What's up?" And I'm like, "Did he just call me a..." And I'm like, are you kidding me? Did they just say that? I said, what? No way. Like, and this game incorporates like this really like obvious. It's really interesting. This not only are there so many unlikable characters, including your character, the kind of language they use, they even beep it out and censor it out. And that was fascinating to me.
Completely.
That like the some of the words they use, they censor because they know they're bad.
It gets the point across.
This game is fucking incredible.
What's even better is the word is not it's somewhat similar to the one that you're thinking of, but they made it up specifically for the game. But it doesn't take away from the effectiveness.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which is really
good. My jaw dropped. I said, did he just say that?
Well, it's kind of like the SpongeBob episode where he sees the profanity on the.
Yes, it's like, dude, I want to know if that's where they got it from.
I like the little like seal noise and stuff. No, I great effective because it's very, unless you have a specific type of build, you're probably going to get like smoked by this kid. Yeah. He's just going to like tear you down right in front of everybody.
Yep.
And Yeah, I thought this was a very effective kind of first little challenge for you because it's just a little kid. Like, and he's like,
Kyuno doesn't fucking care.
Hear that a lot.
Yeah. So you have to deal with him, and the body has been hanging there for so long because your character is such a fuck up. Yeah. So at this point, it's like, it smells too bad to even approach. Ugh. So it's just like, I think you find his ledger in the dumpster, yes. And you wind up calling the station. Everyone at the other end of the line is like, are you kidding me? You haven't got the body down yet? And it's all like everyone at the station is just in disbelief at like this alleged like new low that you've reached.
And I think, Craig, if I'm wrong here, like I believe you have to solve this crime because you are the cop on duty because you're there.
Right.
And it happened when you were there, even though you were a total fucking bum.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
He was on a huge bender.
Yeah.
And basically kind of. You can kind of put the pieces together that he had like a relationship that didn't work out. And, you know, he's pretty much like at the end of his rope. There's not a lot of hope in the world left. Mm-hmm. And what I find so compelling about this story is just doing this one simple job is like
arduous.
Can this guy find purpose in his life again? And it's like a very kind of like on one level humorous, on another level, like tragic.
Yeah.
So that was a pretty interesting first impression. And while this is going on, I mentioned there is a strike mm-hmm. going on. And there's a lot of these sort of ruffians hanging around. There's a lot of truck drivers who are stuck there. You are basically, you need to get into the harbor to try and like piece together what's happening to you. And the first guy in your way is this dude called Measurehead.
I love this character because of how ridiculous it is.
He's unbelievable.
He's completely absurd. He's basically like The Rock, if The Rock was really racist.
Yeah.
And what I found so fascinating is that this game, not only, it's not like a, it's so kind of beyond like what a lot of other games would do, which is like you have this one like super racist character. There are multiple and they're of like different ethnicities. So yep. It's just like, oh my God, like these, like it's very like kind of true to life. Yeah, go ahead.
The game puts you in like, what's so interesting about that character beyond he's just ridiculous. I got into a dice roll scenario where I had to collaborate with him to make any progress.
Right.
Because he can actually help you get the body down.
Yeah.
And yep. Am I wrong? Can't he actually teach you racism as a thought
to get past
him? He was like absurd.
You can either like roundhouse kick him, like if it's you just kind of pull it out if you have enough of your
that's what I save scum to do
physical instrument.
Kick him. Yep.
So you can either do that or you can sort of like talk to him and speech check him, and he gives you that idea. And what I found fascinating about this is that once you explore it further, you realize that he's very kind of well-spoken and he has a lot of like bullshit, but it is bullshit. Like you will basically uncover that all of these are from, like, he's not even where he says he's from. And he has all this misplaced pride that's covering up these like insecurities. I thought it was fascinating. So you eventually sort of get into this harbor shipyard area, and your objective is finding your character's lost gun.
Yep.
And you wind up meeting this guy called Everett Clare, who is like the union boss.
Hello, Harry.
And he's a real like slimy piece of shit.
Yep.
So on the other end of the spectrum, representing the company, is Joyce.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very interesting character, I thought. She is pretty much trying to find out who is smuggling drugs through the port and who's circumventing sort of this blockade, I guess. And what I found fascinating about this character, this is kind of what I was talking about earlier, where if you ask a lot of stupid questions, like about how the world works, my mind was really blown about how the Isolas, as I was talking about, are separated by this, what they call the Pale. Mm-hmm. Which is sort of a sea of non-existence or unreality. And that sort of becomes a very important aspect of this game. And I thought it was fascinating that the money is also called real.
Like, oh, like wow. Real.
Hmm. and she will basically explain this to you. You could turn to Kim and be like, Kim, this is fucking mind-blowing.
And Kim just wants nothing to do with
like,
it.
He doesn't want you to know because he knows you can barely handle the case as it is. And no, I thought it was a very interesting character. You have the Hardy Boys, which I thought
love
was really
that.
Funny.
It's, they're fantastic. Titus I love Hardy.
Just like kind of a gang of, I guess they work there.
Mm-hmm.
And
ruffians.
The gardener I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Oh, she's actually part of the.
She's like their lawyer.
Yeah, that's what it is.
And mm-hmm. It just seems like an innocuous NPC at first.
Right.
And you find out that they pretty much cop to the hanging, but you can kind of tell they're lying.
Mm-hmm.
They're covering from somebody. This is kind of like when I met them, that was kind of the point where I got the body down and I got like the one in a million like gunshot.
Oh, you got the shot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh, nice.
Like you said, you can also enlist Measurehead is because he's super tall and he's strong. He can help you get it.
I had to do that. I failed the shot.
He
I
just
had to
rips
get
the body from the tree.
Yeah.
And I thought this part was like absolutely insane was when you are doing sort of the autopsy on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
The I don't know if you guys got this, but like you can kind of just do all the normal, you know, like checking for his neck, for the contusions, all this other stuff, like his tattoos and scars and everything. But if you have Inland Empire, you can like listen to you can speak with him, number
yeah,
one.
Yeah, you can speak with the ghost of him. Yep. Yeah, and yep.
you,
I did.
And you can listen to sort of this voice that's telling you, reach into this man's mouth. And you reach in and you pull out a bullet
yep.
that's in his head. And it's like your deep kind of subconscious. It's like there's no reason behind it. Just put your hand in this guy's mouth and like pull it out. And I was like, wow, this game is fucking insane.
I got that on my first playthrough. I was like, wow.
I did not get that.
Yeah,
it's so I did cool. not know that. I did not know he had a bullet in his mouth until mm-hmm. later on.
It's pretty wild.
I mean, have you mentioned the woman in the hotel? I don't think we have yet.
No. Which so is she's really there important. Right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you kind of see her out of frame, like on the rooftop smoking for a long time.
What's her name again?
Glacia.
And this is one of the most interesting parts of the game here is that when you're talking to her, pretty much all of your skills are taking what she says at face value,
mm-hmm.
except for volition,
mm-hmm.
which is realizing that like something doesn't add up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when your skills start like arguing with each
mm-hmm.
other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating. I've never seen anything like that because what do you listen to? You know, who do you trust? I thought that was crazy because they're all pretty much having these conflicting where you have to keep going back and forth, getting the story straight about what happened to this guy. Like he was clearly shot at some point.
Yep.
And then they hanged him as like a cover up.
Mm-hmm.
And this only happens when you talk to the woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's
so this game's really true to life then.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I'm moving sorry on here.
Jesus Christ.
No, so you know what was I thought maybe one tiny missed opportunity here was so basically the entire first part of the game you're in this neighborhood and then on day three, I believe, this bridge gets fixed
yes.
after your character fucked it up.
Yeah,
you
know, right. Yeah.
And I thought it would have been a good opportunity to have one of your skills, you know, kind of be able to fix it early. Something
I can
like
agree
that.
With that. Yeah.
I think they may have hinted at it and it just doesn't do anything.
So you know what's funny about that? You can try to fix it early. You get a game over sequence because you electrocute yourself.
That's awesome.
But really? You can try. Yeah. It doesn't work.
Before we actually move on to more gameplay, there are actually some like fundamentals of your daily task that I think are important to follow.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, part of your objectives are you have to find your gun, your badge, what is your real name? Like, you find out soon to there, you crashed your car.
Yeah.
And like,
that's
one
where
of,
you get your badge.
Yeah.
Right?
And one of my favorite parts about this game is like, you can call back to the district and try to get help to find your gun and your badge, but you're trying not to tell them you lost it.
Yeah. They think you're kidding.
Yeah. It's so funny.
Well, if you tell them that you lost the gun, they'll kind of be snickering in the background.
Yeah.
And one of them's like, ask him if he's lost his badge. And then you can like confess to it. They're like, oh my fucking God, are you serious?
Yeah.
I don't think I ever confessed to losing my gun to them.
Oh, really?
I think I told them I did lose the badge, though.
Yeah.
I mean, so you get you get kind of a beat on that from that guy Everett Clare. Well, he's the one who says that your name is Harry Dubois because you're HDB, right?
Yeah.
Or he calls you Harry.
Fun fact, if your conceptualization, I believe that's the skill, is high enough or you keep believing it, you can convince yourself that your name is actually Raphael Astorius Cousteau.
Oh, yeah, I got that. I forgot about that. Yep.
Yeah.
That's insane.
I believe that is tied in with conceptualization and the art cop.
Yes. You know, you brought up also that's where you find your badges in the crashed car. Mm-hmm. And I love that there's like some quiet moments in this game where you and Kim are just sitting on like the swing set and you have to wait for the ice to melt or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're just having a little conversation. That was really nice. So I just wanted to bring up before we get too far to find your lost gun. I never did.
I did.
Because I didn't want to work with Everett Clare. Mm-hmm. But can you talk about the process of getting your gun back? Because I didn't even watch a video.
Yeah.
About
so, I mean, Kyle, I did this. I think you did as well, right? Getting your gun back.
Yeah. Did you meet the pigs?
Yeah. So essentially, like, I'll give you the really, really short summary of this. Like, to get your gun back, you find... Essentially, there's like this, I don't know the right word for this. There is a woman essentially waving it around and you have to have this like insane dialogue with her to get it back from her. What other details do you know about this?
So you first find out about this character from Titus Hardy.
Yes.
Because you're like, you kind of press him on, where's my gun? Mm-hmm. And then I think eventually he's kind of like tells you like, oh, you got to go find the pigs.
Yep. Mm. Yep.
The pigs has your gun. And when you find the pigs, it's this deranged woman with a bunch of police sirens who's waving around like that.
Yes,
that's
and
awesome.
And if you have, I don't know if this happened for you, but if your reaction speed is high enough, or I think it's perception, it's like, the gun's not loaded.
Yep.
So you like convince her to drop it.
Yep.
And she does. And then you have that one chance where it's like, this is your chance. Pick it up now or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you don't actually need to get your gun back,
you don't need it.
Before we move on to the next subject, you can stop me if we're going to talk about this next. You were talking about the quiet moments in the game. Before you even get that far, there was actually a very touching moment. I don't know if you guys remember this, where I believe you are reviewing a clipboard or a notebook of some kind, and you end up fainting because you start thinking about like a relationship of yours that failed. You guys remember this?
I thought the game like crashed.
Yes, me too.
It's very much like an Arkham Asylum scarecrow moment where it's like
fourth wall breaking.
Yeah, a little bit, because it pulls up the splash page that says Disco Elysium, but then you continue and you just come to.
Yeah. This game really, beyond it being like really funny and like shocking and the dialogue is amazing.
Yeah.
They have these very tender moments that are very surprising. Like, I didn't think reviewing my case notes would just cause me to faint because I'm thinking about how my life is so fucked up.
Yeah.
And then Kim actually comments on it because you're passed out and there are these moments like this that are just very touching. There's other stuff later too, but let's keep going.
That's why I mentioned the ace is high and ace is low.
Of course.
It's such a goofy little thing that it's just cute.
Yeah.
It's like a bonding moment between them.
I'm glad you brought up the ledger because, I mean, part of the reason he passes out, right, is because he starts to remember he was a superstar cop at one point.
Several solved crimes.
He was very decorated.
Mm-hmm. And it gives Kim a little bit more respect for you because initially he's just like, all right, what's going on
with
this
guy? What's up with this bum here?
And you know, it's kind of, it makes their relationship a little more complicated. He respects you a little bit more. So this other half of the game here where you're kind of in the dock, sort of fishing hamlet area, I guess.
Go to the fishing hamlet.
Yeah.
Find the orphan of Kos.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I like this area and it's very sort of, it's a little bit more scaled back and quiet and you're kind of meeting some interesting characters. And this is where you can find that like shack. You can convince that old lady to let you like
live there for free.
Yeah,
pretty incredible. So you wind up finding a member of the gang in one of these buildings, and she sort of traps you, I guess, at one point when you confront her, and you kind of like assume that she is the killer. But it's one thing leads to another, and you realize it's just kind of another red herring. And you're sort of following the trail here, but when you you come back to the town square, and this is kind of where all your, you know, your kind of decisions in these key moments, like, did I get my badge, did I get my gun, etc. Like, this is sort of where they come to a head here. Mm-hmm. Because the company mercenaries or whatever, like this guy's comrades, the dead man, his comrades are getting impatient about like justice for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wind up, they have a confrontation with the Hardy Boys in the town square. And this played out for me, I imagine, very different from you, Greg and Kyle, because I didn't have my gun.
Yeah. Yep, me too.
I just wanted to point out, so before the tribunal, which is the mercenaries.
Which is the conflict that we're referring to.
Yeah. Before that, when you meet that person in the fishing village, I think her name is Ruby.
Yeah. Yep.
So I don't know how you guys played this out, but what I do is I tackle like the noise machine.
Yeah.
She plays like a deafening noise. Mm. But as soon as you do that, she pulls out her gun. Is it like gonna like commit suicide?
Yes,
and does. You have to convince her not to do it.
Yeah.
And if you fail, that's a game over.
Yeah.
Which I find like, wow, that is.
It's a game over?
It's a game over. Ooh. Yeah.
Because it's like your last lead, I guess.
It's your last lead.
Mm hmm.
Granted, it's a little weird because you let her go, but
mm-hmm.
Right.
I do want to point out here, because when we start talking about the tribunal, we're going to get into a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
I want to, we've been very, effusive in our praise about Disco Elysium. I just want to point out, we're going to talk about this at the end. In my view, right when you have this conflict with Ruby, when you track her down, this until the end of the game, we do, in my opinion, get a little bit of a downtrend in the game, but why don't you continue and I will expound on that later.
So you can also, like, over the course of the game, that the dead man's armor has been stripped from him.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find, like, pieces of that and wear it, which I did, for this encounter, and it will save your life.
Yep.
And essentially, I think however this plays out, Kim can get injured,
mm-hmm.
and you know, he can't die, right?
No,
like he can
no.
just get it. So he's sort of taken off the case or whatever. Your partner becomes Kuno, the little boy.
Yeah. So if you, it's pretty hard to not have Kim survive this, but if he doesn't, Kuno becomes your partner, which is hilarious.
Unbelievable.
Kim survived through me.
Me too.
Hey, he survived for me too, some fucking how. I didn't have my gun.
I mean,
it
gets crazy. Like I had the gun. And you do end up, you know, shooting a bunch of people, and you can get shot too. There's a lot of stuff that can happen.
I got shot a lot of times, but because I had the armor, I survived.
Yeah, right. Me too.
So I figured maybe before we get into the end game, we can talk about some like notable side quests and characters.
Oh, sure.
So for one, for me, the clerk of the store, Freet.
Yeah,
I thought was like an unbelievable voice performance. I've never heard someone do it that good before, where it's this very kind of glum sort of, you know, I hope your drugs make you feel better. I thought that was very remarkable. I liked the old guys who were arguing. The old soldier and his buddy.
Yeah. I have an interesting, I'll mention it later. Yeah, Renee and I forget the other guy's name.
Gaston, I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, the soldier dies towards the end of the game. And it's pretty tragic.
Yeah, well, they hated each other, but they also really liked each other's company.
Well, they have kind of a sort of a begrudging relationship because they both dated the same woman, I believe, and they kind of through their love of her have kind of a bond. You have also the bookstore, which was interesting.
Very interesting.
She was interesting.
Pretty cool subplot where you find a sort of secret passage in the back and
the doomed commercial area.
So you have essentially, when it's very early in the game, you find all these buzzers on a building and like only a couple of them work, and then you, one of them, it's kind of like you feel like a distant voice from a distant memory or something. And it's like, man, that's kind of interesting. And you wind up making your way into this building, and it's sort of a cursed commercial area where a lot of businesses have failed. And it's fascinating because you have essentially what I believe is like Zaum Studios in the game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there's like a failed, like it was going to be the best RPG ever.
The Dice Maker.
Yeah. And you have the woman who makes dice and she, I think the dice can give you certain like attributes or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really compelling, and it also kind of ties in with what you learn later. Kyle, you mentioned the mega rich light bending guy. I thought this was amazing.
Yeah, this was really funny. So when you're going on your way to visit Evrart, there's a shipping container that's just like in the air. You can bring it down, and I believe you have to have high rhetoric in order to open it.
But you have to convince the door.
You have to convince the door to open, and Kim's just looking at you like, there's nothing in there, dude. Like, what the hell are you doing?
Right.
But if you, and this is one thing I did save Scum, because I'm like, I gotta know if something's in here. Turns out there is.
Yep.
And it's Jeffrey Bezos. I'm just kidding.
My God.
It's this character named the Mega Rich Lightbending Guy.
Yeah.
And what's really funny is if you look at your Real counter as you approach him, it goes off the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's funny because like as you're talking to him, you're just like, Kim, are you seeing this? He's like, what? The light, it's bending around him. And he's just like, no, I just see a person.
Oh my God.
Well, it's that the idea is, I've never seen this, anything like this before, is that this man is so unbelievably wealthy that
he warps reality.
Exactly. And he's
he warps reality.
Yeah.
There you go.
Leave. Yeah.
Another concept that I liked was the guy and his son in front of the old building, the Wompty Dumpty Dom Center. Because holy shit, that is such a perfect name, because they all like, that's such like a weird like German thing, like it's the only like anglicized thing about yes the Wumpty Dumpty Dumps. It's always some stupid name like that. You know what I mean? I thought that was a very, very well implemented. He's just kind of like this like middle-aged guy who's telling you about the history of the area. And
well, here's the thing, I mean, if we're talking about side quests, we got to talk about a really important one. Did you guys do the rave or kick him out? What did you do?
Oh, I did the rave. Are you kidding me?
Do the rave.
I mean,
I couldn't do the rave.
What happened?
I couldn't pass the check. I had to kick them out.
I kicked them out.
Yeah, I kicked them out.
Did you guys want to do the rave? I thought they were just like kind of bastards, so I just kicked them out.
I did the rave because it's the best song in the game.
Sure. Let me tell you. I mean, here's where you and I differ, Greg. I grant these youths their opportunity. I say no drugs in the rave.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I did.
So like you're kind of giving them a little bit of an arc, and like you kind of
sure
this bizarre sort of moral compass for these kids. Like, so you basically you find this church that is when you walk into it, it's an odd sort of silence, like an unnatural silence, sort of pervades it. And you wind up meeting that scientist,
Suna,
and she winds up doing some sort of experiments with it. And what you realize is, and I thought this was a very creative concept, that the pale, which I mentioned earlier, with the unreality that sort of pervades this universe, instead of, they talk about how it's growing in the beginning, and instead of sorting encroaching on the borders of the real world, it's poking like pinholes through it. So this church is one such situation where, you know, the first thing that's going is the sound, so you can't hear anything. And they talk about how the failed business park is another one of those situations, and that's why all these you know, people are, you know, experiencing such financial failure. And what you wind up doing is, I guess, because of that, those qualities, like you let the kids have their rave in there because it's going to be self-contained.
You find
all the different parts of it. Like you can like find like the bass part and stuff, and like help them work on the song together.
I don't want to belabor this too much. We should move on. Isn't this the part where you can like talk to a man in the ceiling?
Thank you. I was hoping one of you would bring up the crab man.
What the fuck was that?
It's just a guy.
He's just chilling, dude.
I think he's just hanging out on the top of the church.
It's a normal guy, but he's spent so much time around that he's kind of like a little out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, because that's the idea, right? That he was running away from something, and he's like trying to absolve himself in the church.
Yep.
But like, because he spent so much time there, his mind is a little fried. And so you just see like a shadow in the ceiling, and it's just kind of this guy like looming down on you.
It's so bizarre.
It's so weird.
It's one of those things where it's just, you know, it's ultimately just a dude, but it's the way it's presented to you is very almost supernatural.
I believe his name is Tiago.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. Or as they call it, Supra.
Where did you want to take us next?
Could I actually, sorry, I haven't talked about the characters yet. There is like two that I would like to speak of.
Sure.
One of them that like broke my heart, and I really want to talk about Leonard, the cryptozoologist's wife, a little bit. After you do her side quest, like with the crypto stuff, the cryptid stuff, you put the pheromones on you, all that good stuff. You set the traps. You go back to her. And honestly, I don't know if you all got this conversation, but man, this tugged at my heartstrings. She says, listen, we were trying to find this phasmid. I thought I saw it when I was a little girl. I don't think it actually exists, but that's how I met my husband. Do we actually have love, or was it just about the phasmid? And there's a red check that you can say, yes, this is actually love. But if you fail it, it's like, oh my God, no, she doesn't believe you. That like, dude, that broke my heart, man.
Oh yeah.
There's just one more guy that I want to bring up because he says one of my favorite quotes in the game. It's the man with sunglasses. He's actually Harry's partner in disguise.
Yes.
But so what I didn't know is I read this after beating the game. Harry doesn't remember who he is, but you actually get a morale heal when you tell him about the case, and he says it seems familiar.
Oh, really?
So it's like he kind of has a thought like he knows this guy, but you don't know where.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, Mammoth Sunglasses has one of the best quotes I've ever seen in this game. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm clinically depressed, Harry. Sorry if I wasn't in the mood to butter you up after you told us to fuck off.
Riley, do you want to move on?
Yes, let's move on.
Yeah, just getting into the end here. So you wind up back up on the roof, I guess. You kind of reconstruct that a bullet was fired through the window. Mm-hmm. And you find this previously unexplored part of the map, which is like an island. It's kind of on your map, but you can't reach it, I guess. You can kind of see it from, there's a cute little side quest where you go on a date with that lady. I don't know if you did that one.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, really sweet. But it's like an old fortress or something, and you wind up making your way there with Kim. And you wind up meeting the killer, who is an old like soldier or war veteran, and he's like very bitter, and he, I guess for whatever reason, he had an axe to grind with the murder victim, and was somewhat envious of his relationship with Klaasia. And he wound up just shooting him with a sniper rifle. Like one of those like from the top rope moments. Like, holy shit, it's Bernie Sanders with a steel chair.
Yeah.
He's just very like, he's the ultimate like doomer.
Oh yeah.
Kind of character. His name is the Deserter, right? Mm-hmm. And it's insane to me. And at the end of the game, it's this absolutely bonkers moment is that the phasmid that they've been looking for the whole time comes out of the reeds and negotiates with you.
This part blew me away.
I thought it was. So I have some thoughts.
Greg's
on
nodding.
This.
It's a good moment, Greg.
You mean shaking my head? But go ahead, Riley.
So let me tell you about my sort of relationship with this moment. Is I was very kind of taken aback by. That the killer was just some guy. And initially it didn't really work for me. But I've been thinking about it for months, and I think I have finally sort of cracked this ending. And basically my interpretation of it is that this guy is a complete unknown. Is like absolutely unpredictable, has no relationship to your case at all. The phasmid is a giant creature, and if you have like the Inland Empire, you can actually converse with it and have a conversation. It's a very, I think, one of the most beautiful conversations in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And what this represents to me, this whole ending, is so much of this game is sort of colored by what you know and your character's sort of preconceived notions about the world and your dogma. And just sort of all this like trying to piece together what you know based on history and what is directly in front of you. And this entire endgame is basically illustrating that there is so much we don't know in every respect, and that's in the physical realm and the metaphysical.
I want to make sure our audience understands what we're talking about. The cryptozoologists have been mentioning this creature called the Phasmid. And when you get into this conversation with this person who ends up being the murderer, this mysterious Phasmid that may or may not exist appears at that moment. So I want to make sure that's clear to people who may not understand what's going on.
So
go ahead, Kyle.
Kind of piggybacking off of what Riley just said, what I really appreciate about this game is kind of... and it's a bit of an overused phrase at this point, but it subverts your expectations, because what happens is when you find the murder victim and you see him hanging, you're like, oh, it must have been the Hardy Boys. And then you talk to them and it's like, something's not right with them. And if you pass that check where you can pull the bullet out of the guy's mouth, that's when you start to realize, oh, there's a little bit more to this. You come to that conclusion anyway, that he's been shot. And when you're on the balcony, you're like, okay, there's three possible trajectories. There's B prime, B double prime, B triple prime. You're like, well, it's got to be B prime. It's the most logical. It's not that. You go to B double prime. All right, maybe it was from, not that one either. And then when you get to the island, which is where B triple prime is, you're like, son of a bitch. It's a like clear shot right into the window. So it's really cool because it like completely subverts your expectations, where it's like, wow, it's the least likely option, and that's what happened. And the cryptozoologist, to me, kind of relates to that, because in my first playthrough of the game, I was just entertaining it because I thought it was funny.
Well,
like, I didn't believe in them at all.
You know, piggybacking onto that, I want to reiterate how much of this game relates to chance and percentages and likelihoods, and the fact that so much of it hinges on like that 1% of possibility is pretty, it's an interesting kind of reversal of that, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So when you get to the point where you're on the island, you're about to go meet the deserter. By the way, if you zoom out, because the Phasmid they mentioned looks like a bundle of reeds.
Right.
And where the deserter is surrounded by reeds. You can actually see the Phasmid in the reeds. You'll see like a little bit of movement. Hmm. If you're playing it for the first time, you're not going to notice it.
Right.
But on my second playthrough, because I know it's coming, you can actually look and see a little bit of sway. Hmm. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. It's been there the whole time.
Right.
And as Riley was saying, it's this really bitter old man. And when you go through his conversation, he just admits he killed the guy because he was jealous of Clausia.
Yeah,
he's been so lonely.
Well, and it's crazy to me because you have ultimately this extremely negative example of humanity, like pretty much every flaw that humanity has exhibited is existing in this guy. And then you have this otherworldly entity that is very pure and like fascinating.
And you find out that at that moment, the deserter starts to go a bit insane. Because I guess it's like the pheromones from this Phasmid.
It has like a residual effect.
Yeah, been keeping him sane, and exposing the Phasmid or something in that moment causes him to kind of like his mental stability just kind of fries. But I thought that was really cool because I was 100% not expecting that at all. And I realized for some that might be kind of really stupid. I thought it was really cool because it was just like a big X-Files moment.
Nick, do you want to speak on this ending portion before I do? I think I'm going to be the naysayer here.
Yes, please. So, okay. I have complicated feelings about the ending of this game. I don't think it's particularly good, but hear me out. Disco Elysium it's a cliched phrase, but this game is more about the journey than the destination.
Yep.
Zaum tried to land the triple axel with this ending. But they kind of stumbled and fell on the ice at the end, in my opinion. I don't think the deserter is really that great of a killer. I think his motivations are a little meh. Oh, he's meh. I don't know. I don't buy it, to be honest with you. I don't buy it. And what makes that worse is you can miss the Phasmid. You can totally miss it. You do not have to see it.
Really?
So if you miss the Phasmid and you just see this guy, That is an extremely disappointing ending.
I did not know that.
It is very disappointing if that happens. Now, the conversation with the deserter is fascinating. And I do like what they like one thing they do, which is the deserter and Harry are sort of the same person in a way. They're both so clinging to the past, they can't let go. But Harry's journey is him trying to let go of that past and become a better person.
Right.
Whereas the deserter is going to stay the same, and he does not want to change.
It's a little bit of Batman and Riddler, you know, two sides of the same coin here.
I would have preferred if I don't mind that this guy is the killer if I had had some inkling of it beforehand. I'm not a huge fan of surprise.
You align like with this. Me more on this than I thought you would.
Well, it's because I'm not a huge fan of the killer. When the Phasmin showed up, I cheered. I clapped.
I loved it because I did not expect it.
So here's what it is about the Phasmid that I absolutely loved. Harry, this whole time, Harry has been curious about the world. And when you go to the Phasmid, you get it says in the game, it's a childlike curiosity, just like what Harry is. And he says him and the Phasmid have this incredible conversation where you can tell the Phasmid, the Phasmid asks you, what were you born to do? And Harry says, detect you. This is my masterpiece. Which is great, because this absolute disaster of a cop makes one of the world's most incredible discoveries the very end. And
you take the photo with it.
Exactly. The Phasmid says almost no one believed he existed until Harry came along.
Right.
Which is like, that's Harry's character. He asks so many questions. He wants to believe these really incredible parts of the world. And I do love that about this ending. When Harry tells the Phasmid that it's insane that no one has seen him for hundreds of years, the Phasmid says, no, I'm not insane. You are. I am a median life form. You are madness. Yeah. And I'm like, he's talking about like the human race being a form of madness. And I'm just getting blown away by this. Go ahead.
You have so much, something recently I was watching or listening to is just like so much about it is how abhorrent human beings are.
Yeah.
And a lot of this game is about how complicated our minds are and all these different like insane reasons of why we do things.
Yep.
And then you find a representative of nature that can communicate with you. And they're like, you guys are fucking nuts. You know what I mean? Like, and there are reasons for doing things that they have their own sort of fears and agency and stuff like that. And I thought it was kind of interesting to see yourself from that perspective as well.
Totally. So I'll end my feelings on the ending with literally what the Phasmid tells you. The last little thing you say, for the parting words for the Phasmid, you can tell it if it's kind, you can say it's beautiful, or you can say it's scary. And in return, it tells you, that woman, turn from the ruin. She was middle class. It doesn't take a 3-meter stick insect to tell you that. And that is how the conversation ends. And it goes away. And I'll say, if you have any ounce of like, it's like, this game is not based in reality. It's really not. And when you have that sort of extension of your imagination with Harry and finding this Phasmid and conversing with it and everything it tells you, for some bizarre reason, this ridiculous thing that comes out of nowhere at the end makes more sense than anyone you've talked to throughout the game.
Oh, yeah. And it's about sort of, I mean, everything in this game is working against the idea of possibilities. And like, it's a pretty explicitly doomed world.
Mm-hmm.
But when you consider, you know, the unknown and the, you know, whatever, it's kind of giving you sort of like, wow, there is a lot that maybe there is a chance that we can survive somehow. You
know? All right. We've sang this game's praises enough. Let's hear Greg ruin it.
Oh no.
Okay. So, you guys are so effusive about like the ending of this game. So can you
do me a favor?
Of course.
Can you acknowledge our responses and your response and how maybe you still feel the same, you know, or address our.
So what's so funny is when Nick was talking about this Phasmid, like, you almost made me like it. But like, here's what happened. Here's what happened with me. Where I'll try to, you know, we've gone for this episode is also getting quite lengthy, so I'm not going to go on forever about this. Here's what maybe bothered me about the last 10% of Disco Elysium. This is an incredible game. And I mentioned maybe about 20 minutes back where I said, as soon as you talk to Ruby, the game to me does kind of a downturn where it seems like you're talking to all these characters, you're unraveling so much mystery, there's almost stuff, and then the game just kind of ends. So we'll get right to the point here. I did not love how, like, you don't interact with the deserter at all throughout the whole game. There's no inkling he's even a character. It has a 1% chance that the bullet came from that direction. And then you find the murderer and it's immediately him. And then this crazy creature, like, interrupts the conversation. What bothered me, I think... Our friend Will actually agreed with me on this. What bothered me was that you're at the climax of the murder plot, but then this side quest comes out of nowhere and is now a major plot point. That bothered me. Like, it took me, like, what you guys are saying makes a lot of sense, yeah. But this game is not actually based in reality, but they're trying to make you think it is. But this, I think this was a little bit too detached from realistic to me, and it took me out of the moment rather than engaged me. And like, I thought this crypto monster quest that I thought was just kind of a strange side quest, it ends up being a major plot point and they both collide at the same time, and I just didn't buy it. It just wasn't for me, and I just think I'm in the minority where I don't know. There's no inkling that this killer existed. Now we're solving it immediately. Mm-hmm. There's no inkling that this Phasmid is going to have a major stamp on the plot. Now he's here too.
Hey, I'm with you on the deserter.
For me, it's like that these people are demonstrably very thoughtful about everything they do. And I try to do this a lot if I trust the author.
Yeah.
Like, what did they mean by this? And I think this was all completely purposeful for you to even have that reaction.
Yeah.
Was obviously they thought like people would yep. think about this, but it's one of those things where I think that the murderer being someone who has not even been a presence mm-hmm. was the point of the resolution mm-hmm. yep. at this point.
Maybe.
Whether it works for you or not is a whole different conversation, but yeah. I do think it was considered.
I think the Phasmid interrupting that conversation, I thought it was like kind of funny, but not in a good way. Where I said, oh my God, like, why? Why is this happening? This is too silly for me. And maybe I didn't think of it in like the very wholesome philosophical way that you guys did. I just said, okay, now this game is kind of jumping the shark and the last 10% has been kind of rushed and I don't know.
Well,
this is kind
of
weird.
If you think about it in terms of like a logical progression yeah. of things, it doesn't make a lick of sense.
Of course.
Can I yeah. interject real quick here?
Yeah.
What do you think about the secret Silent Hill 2 ending?
I mean, you can't get it the first time through, so it's okay.
Yeah. I think overall it is a incredibly unique ending.
Yeah.
I can see sure. I can yeah. totally understand it didn't I didn't think of it as ridiculously as like the Hulk Hogan
sure.
fight, something like that. I thought it was definitely, I don't think the Hulk Hogan thing was considered at all. I think this was considered.
Mm-hmm. Oh sure.
You know, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
But I like that you have a little bit of a moment with his ex-wife in sort of a dream sequence.
Yes, thank mm-hmm. you for bringing that up.
I like that yes. a lot, where she is sort of their religious figure
yeah.
in this Dolorous Day. Yeah. The Innocents
yeah.
Represents his ex-wife, mm-hmm. who is like pops into the story here and there. Like, you can call her, I think, at one point.
Yeah.
And it's a really... really heart-rending conversation.
Yeah,
I think that was
see
that
those were
me.
Those were the deeply affecting moments for me.
Well, yeah.
I feel like I'm kind of a sucker for that stuff anyway. It's grounded yeah. in a very human story.
No, I agree, and that's yeah. a really interesting one to get because you have to be alone at the payphone.
Yes,
and you have to have a high of enough interfacing skill and your fingers just do the dialing like by muscle memory.
Right. Yeah.
And you call her. It's like, it's late at night. What are you up to? And you just kind of freeze and you like lose morale.
Yeah.
And I think it mentions you can hear someone on the other side of the bed turning around.
Ugh.
Well, it's just like, oh, I never caught that. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, they mentioned too that, so basically when you have this sort of surreal meeting, that the island at the end, you fall asleep there, I believe.
Yes. Yes.
And that's when this happens. Yes. And it's so fascinating because this island, I believe, is also affected a little bit by the unreality.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you're having this weird, trippy dream where your ex-wife is also God, I guess.
Yeah.
So, and there's my favorite line in the game happens here where you listen to one of your inner voices that says to kiss her. And you can succeed, and she's like upset. And the voice line says, "Brother, you should put me on the firing squad for that one."
Yeah.
Yes, I got that. That was so fucking funny.
Words cannot express how much I failed you.
Dude, I just love how all the skills just have, like, how intricate they are with their wording.
Now we're running very long here on this episode. Riley, did you want to take us to, like, the actual final moment of the game, or where did you want to take us as we run towards the end?
There's not a lot to say about the actual ending. It's just kind of, you know, you have a little review with Nick. You mentioned your old partner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he mentions he's been watching you. I don't know how this varies depending on what happened, but Kim, in my case, got invited to join their department, and you kind of are hints at, you know, adventures to come, I guess.
Sure. It's like really the final 5 minutes is really like the district gives you a rundown of, like, essentially, are they giving you your honor back or not?
Right.
Right. That's really how it shakes out.
And depending on how you treat Kim the whole game, he'll either vouch for you
or not.
Or not. You can.
Yeah.
That's what's really cool about this game. I was really nice to Kim because
I
personally really like him. I think he's an excellent character.
Incredibly well voiced, too. Oh, I shouldn't even mention that.
But you can do the ultra fascist route where you're just completely a dick to him. I think he actually leaves you.
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's that's just awesome. Like, I love that that's a thing.
Yeah.
He'll of course. Just
that it's
leave
even
you.
An option.
Yeah. I mean, well, so I think in this final, what I think this is also, I'm sorry that this game is really good, but I think there's a little flaw in this ending too, where there are some side quests that affect the ending you get that seem like I didn't understand. I didn't realize that this was so important. Like, what are the main points? Like, it's your gun, your badge, discovering the phasmid, the murder. There's this really small subplot where you actually find a dead body on the pier.
I did
and
find
you actually
that.
Have to report it and solve a mini murder within the game.
Kim actually tells you not to.
Yeah.
It's not our problem.
Yeah.
You do it anyway.
There's I think, because we've gone so long, so like, Riley, I'll let you take us to the end here. I think this game for me is like 90% amazing, and I just feel like the last 10%, they kind of run their way to the ending and it ends. Not my favorite, but where do you want to take us so we can wrap?
Yeah, so I just have a last few points for our little epilogue here. So you leave the door open for future adventures. Like, what do you guys want to see, and what do you think will happen? I will start. I would personally like to see a different set of characters in this universe. I think they may resurrect Harry and Kim, but I feel like it gets harder and harder when you have so many choices in this first one. Mm-hmm. It gets harder and harder to build a sequel that acknowledges them appropriately. I could see them like popping in maybe, but I would almost prefer like a new, as hard as it would be to compare. What do you guys think?
I agree with that. I wouldn't want Kim and Harry to be the main characters of the sequel if it takes place.
I feel like
we've
learned almost everything there is to know. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
if it's going to be Harry again, I think it might be interesting if he has an adventure with his old partner and Kim is like the third wheel kind of guy.
Or
might be interesting.
Explore his past a little bit.
Yeah, but I don't think Harry would work again as a main character. We kind of figured it out.
It's hard to undo everything you learned about him to do it again.
Maybe somebody can figure it out, but
Kuno is the main character, obviously.
Kuno.
Kuno's gonna solve the case. Kuno's the best.
The We did want to mention there is an impending Amazon TV series.
Can I just interject here?
An adaptation.
Good Lord, the irony that Amazon is picking this up I for
know.
Series.
Do yeah. they know right. what this is about?
Jeff Bezos thought the ultra rich light bending guy was the main character.
Oh, no.
So my question to you here is there any hope of it being good?
No.
Right.
Listen, if Halo's anything to go off of, no. But I will say I have a few notes of some fan casting if you guys want to hear that.
Sure, really? Sure.
Quick ones. So I only have four characters, not everyone. Harry Dubois. For me, I'd say either Jeff Bridges or Nicolas Cage.
Oh, man.
But I saw a third one online and I kind of like this idea, Hugo Weaving.
Wow.
That'd be interesting.
That'd be interesting.
I can kind of see that.
Kim Kitsuragi. The only two people that I can think of personally would be Steven Yeun or John Cho.
Oh, sure.
I think Daniel Day Kim would be great, too.
He would be excellent as well.
Mm-hmm.
The final two people, I only have one choice for each of them. This one is the only person I could see. Joyce Messier has to be Sigourney Weaver.
Right.
Yeah, I could see that.
100%. Yeah. She looks the same.
Right.
And then... for Harry
Everard.
For Everard, fuck it, Danny DeVito. Just put Danny DeVito in there.
He'd be. I was thinking,
Harry. I like you, Harry.
I was thinking Steven Root, that guy. You know that guy's voice is Bill Dotrieve. So wrapping up here, my last question. I think there are so many things that this game does right. I think the nature of its presentation, as we talked about, allows for a lot of different variables. Like, you know, we talked a lot about they thought of everything. You know, they thought of this, they thought of that, all these variables. So do you think that this game will influence other games at all in any way?
I can start. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, a game that actually gave a shit about its dialogue and its writing is very nice to see.
Yeah.
Not every game has to be built like Disco Elysium, but to have at least the thought and care put behind the dialogue and the narration.
Yeah.
We kind of get that with Divinity and Larian Studios. They do that somewhat to a degree, but... I do, at least that aspect of it, I hope that rubs off on devs.
I was going to say, the only other studio that comes close, I'd say that Zom is like in a league of their own in terms of the dialogue and the writing. Only other studio that comes close is Obsidian for me.
Right.
What do we think about rankings here? Ratings? What do we think?
We're doing final thoughts?
Final
Riley, are we down to rankings and then we're donezo?
That's it.
All right.
Go ahead.
For me, it's a 10. I think it's a 10. I think I think my gripes are a little nitpicks.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was extremely significant to my life and games in general. I have never seen this much effort put into world building and lore and dialogue and all these different systems and stuff. You know, I have my gripes, as I mentioned, but I think... I would feel like an asshole giving it any less. I don't know. I thought it was excellent. I think it's on that. I think the last game I gave a 10 to was MGS2, and I think it's kind of in the same league.
Nick, why don't you go next?
Me next. Okay. So my final thoughts on Disco Elysium. I love... there's three things that they did all in one point. Disco Elysium broke... three rules that writers are, they say you should never do and made them work,
right.
Which is never start a story with a character waking up. Amnesia is a cliche,
yeah.
And a surprise weird twist ending. Even if I didn't like it that much, they did all three of these things that all of the greatest scholars say young writers never do this.
Right.
It's a trap. They did it and it fucking worked. And for that, I give them all of the credit in the world.
That's unbelievable.
I have my gripes with the game, with the thought catalog and with part of the ending. So for me, if we are going on a regular A through whatever scale, I'm going, my scale goes up to A+, and I am giving this game an A.
Nice.
So almost the highest marks can receive, but not quite there.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kyle.
I'm going to give this a number grade. I would say that this for me is like a 9 because this is an excellent game. I can absolutely see why somebody would give it a 10. My personal nitpicks are just that, with the original release, how much you had to read.
Mm-hmm.
I do still have to be in a very specific mindset to play this game. So it's not like something I can play all the time, but it's excellent. Everyone should play it at least once.
So I also give this game an A-. I think this is one of these games where there's a phrase we've used on Goddamn GameCube. We say they thought of everything. Mm-hmm. One of these games, they went above and beyond to think of every action or thing you do and how it could affect everything. They just, it's a very intelligent game. The dialogue is amazing. It's incredibly well written. And it's, I really have to like kind of give a hat tip to games, or I have never played a game like it. Mm-hmm. It is a point and click Nancy Drew investigative game, but it's adult and everything is D&D based, which is insane.
Wouldn't it be the Hardy Boys?
Well done.
I like it.
So anyway, that's a good note to end on. So thank you everybody for being a part of Disco Elysium. It is an excellent game. To answer your question, I don't think we're going to get a game another like this because I don't believe in any developers to do this.
Nope. We shall never see it.
We're
like
never going to see it again. Anyway, this is Goddamn GameCube. Thank you guys very much.